Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of Your Cases on Hold. We're here to talk to you about the news, the tunes, and what's going on in orthopedic surgery. I'm Antonia Chen. I'm deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction, and I have here...
I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods at JBJS.
So here at JBJS, these views are our own, not of the JBJS board or of anyone else at JBJS. This podcast is brought to you by the Miller Review course. Get your learn on if you're taking part one, part two of the boards. Come do a great course and get some really good information from there. Without further ado, let's jump into our lineup. So today, top of the pile, JBJS reviewers, please accept our gratitude and a little bit more. For all of you who are listening and review for JBJS, thank you very much. This is by Suntowski and it's permanently free. If you don't yet review for JBJS, let us know. We'll be glad to bring you on board. Being a reviewer is...
Well, there's a vetting process.
There is a vetting process. You go through the gauntlet.
It isn't as simple as just, hey, I want to review. But what's the little bit more? What have they won?
We got a little bit more. So
what they've won, Antonia.
We want you to contribute to the orthopedic community. So if there's something called an elite reviewer program at JBJS. So if you almost always accept invitations to review and respond to reviewers' requests within 48 hours, review four more manuscripts per year and return these reviews within 1 week and receive high grades for the quality of your reviews, you can be an elite reviewer. And what's the benefit of it? Whenever you do that JBJS submission, that fee is waived, which is very nice. You can also get CME credits, not if you're just an elite reviewer, but if you're not an elite reviewer, if you just review for JBJS, you also get CME credits, which is really nice. So you get a benefit for reviewing. And you get credit on the Web of Sciences as well, too. So this is that little bit more nugget that you can do. You know, reviewing is typically just done out of the goodness of our hearts and for peer review and supporting one another. That said, now you can get CME credit and recognition of Web of Sciences.
Yeah, CME credit is so clutch.
Very nice. I agree with that. So next we have What's New in Hand Surgery by Bone. It's also permanently free. Patient selection in randomized controlled trials of total knee arthroplasty, a systematic review assessing inclusion criteria by Bain. What's Important, The Road to Restoring My Roots, an essay by a third culture kid by Nizal. This is permanently free. And an obituaries for Sigvard Theodore Hansen Jr., MD, 1935 to 2023 by Sands. And this is also permanently free. Why don't you lead us off with the headlines for this week? Using the proximal femur maturity index at brace initiation for adolescent idiopathic scoliosis predicts curve progression risk by Chung et al. It's permanently free, and there's a commentary for it.
In the news from the headlines this week. All right. So this is a nice study that exists at the intersection of pediatrics, but pediatric spine. I think that the interested parties will notice that, you know, both my headline and your headline are in the pediatric space. And so there's some more variety. But even though this is pediatric spine, I don't want to hear it. This is a pediatric article.
Variety is the spice of life. So we are all over that now.
There we go. So there are obviously lots of different ways to look at skeletal maturity and measure skeletal maturity. And that's very important for predicting curve progression and the potential for response to bracing in patients with scoliosis. So this was a very interesting study, which was prospective work that the authors have graded level two evidence. We'll come back to that momentarily. But essentially looking at the proximal femur maturity index and its use in assessing skeletal maturity and predicting curve progression, specifically in patients with adolescent idiopathic scoliosis. And I think that the envisioned advantage of the proximal femoral maturity index, which is great, is that you can see the proximal femoral heads on appropriately obtained standing scoliosis views. So you're not x-raying a young patient with the associated, albeit minor, but still when you talk about, you know, accumulation over time, potentially non-negligible radiation exposure to these young individuals who, when they do have scoliosis that's significant enough, are getting x-rays sequentially over the course of years, if not their lifetime, because some of these individuals even need to have, you know, monitoring after treatment as an adult, or they develop other issues as an adult related to the spine for which additional imaging, x-ray, CT, et cetera, and radiation exposure occur. So instead of doing the scoliosis series and then x-raying their hand or trying to get a Risser stage or something like that, everything, the proximal femurs are included. So it's one-stop shopping. You can assess the skeletal maturity just off of the same images that you're using to visualize and grade the scoliosis. So that's the perceived advantage. So it's a prospective study, 202 patients, and who were treated with bracing and reportedly had all good brace wear compliance. And then they're looking to assess curve progression. And they're wanting to look at progression at to two thresholds, greater than equal to 40 degrees and then greater than equal to 50 degrees, based off of the grade of the proximal femoral maturity, which has six potential grades. And that's included in the figure two of the manuscript. You know, same kind of idea with Risser stage, essentially. And they used logistic regression to model their two primary outcome points, the 40 and 50 degree progression. Now, the first thing that I will say about this, as the avid listener will have heard many times in the past, in most prospective studies, it never fails that we perceive or conceive in our heads that they're going to be this windfall, waterfall of patients with the outcomes of interest, that then ultimately, once you get down to the nitty gritty, it ends up just being like a tiny trickle of a river. And that assuredly is the case here as well. For the patients with curve progression, 40 degrees or more, they only have 23 total patients. And then for curve progression of 50 degrees or more, they only have 9 patients. Those are not numbers on which you can very effectively model risk. Those are insufficient numbers for even what we would consider to be well-adjusted multivariable regression models, let alone they basically do a layered regression analysis, starting with assessing all of them, all the factors in a bivariate comparison to see what's significant, and then including those significant variables in the multivariable test. And there's just a lot of risk for type 2 error in those individual comparisons. So the study may very well be underpowered to detect secondary effects interactions, which then will have an impact on the adjusted estimates overall. And, you know, they give percentages here, the percentages of risk. If you look at their table 3, their percent risk, 33%, 6%. But these are based on very small numbers. The 33% risk in one section is just 4 of 12 patients. In another, it's 2 of 6 patients. They give you the point estimate, but if they also gave you the 95% confidence interval, just based on those numbers, it's going to be very wide. So the precision of their estimates is not provided. And I think that that's a cause for pause and some real caution there. And then, as we've pointed out with other studies in the past, when you look at table 5, particularly for curve progression greater than 50 degrees, they only have one patient who had a curve less than 30 degrees who ever progressed more than 50 degrees. Most of their cells, grade 3, grade 4, they're 0. And, you know, in clinical practice, in medicine, in science, as in life, nothing is never and nothing is always. So when you have a whole bunch of things that say 0, it's just a reflection of the sample being too small to adequately represent the natural history and to have sufficient numbers of the entire comprehensive universe of representative cases of patients with this condition to really effectively model what they say they're trying to model. So what I think is, I think this shows that this proximal femoral maturity index is viable as a measure of maturity. And there are a lot of advantages, as I already, discussed, and it's a very attractive measure. I think before you can really say, oh, we know for sure what these predictive risks are associated with the various stages, that needs to be looked at in a much larger sample. It doesn't need to be prospective. You can do this work. There's nothing about this that really advantages prospective over retrospective. So I would encourage this work to be replicated in a larger multi-center sample so you can get much higher numbers across all the iterations of both the maturity and the curvatures. And I think that would, you know, to the interested listener, if you can do this, I'm sure that paper would be publishable in JBJS. You could even write it in your submission letter and say, we heard Dr. Schoenf. I would stand by that. I'll take the Pepsi challenge with that statement. So I issue a challenge to the pediatric orthopedic surgical community. Do this with more patients, multi-center, larger samples.
I think the thing goes, I feel the power.
You feel the inspiration. People are being inspired by my words as we speak right now.
I'm also saying feeling the power of higher sample sizes, you know, working well. A little play on statistical words.
We'll never say no to higher power.
Oh, give me a higher power. Oh my gosh, there's so many things that we could go off on here. All right. Mine is looking at a large study with more power, actually, looking at pediatrics again, as well as you said too earlier. So I looked at the rate and risk factors for contralateral slippage in adolescents treated for slipped capital femoral epiphyses. A comprehensive analysis of 3,528 cases. This is my Momtaz et al. And there's a visual summary that goes with this. People ask all the time, especially patients, if something happens on one side, what's the likelihood that it's going to happen to the other side? As a hip and knee surgeon, and I had to slip this in somewhere, patients ask me that all the time. You're doing one knee, is it going to happen to the other knee? If you're doing one hip, is it going to happen to the other hip? So this study looks at the rates and risk factors for contralateral slipped capital femoral epiphysis, or SCIFE, in teenagers. And this is looking at is a case control study from 2003 to 2023 in patients less than 18 years old. And cases were those without contralateral SCIFE. So they took a whole group of people who all got unilateral SCIFE, and the case people who did not develop a contralateral SCIFE, and the control case people are those who did develop a contralateral SCIFE, and the control people are those who did not develop a contralateral SCIFE. This is the largest study with 5,528 patients, and they use the TriNetX Research Network, which is a de-identified database. So I say the nice thing about that is that you got a large cohort of patients. And the minimum follow-up was of 2 years. They have 2 years of records, and it excluded patients who underwent a prophylactic pinning of the contralateral hip. So again, they couldn't identify whether or not they did or did not have a SCIFE if they had a prophylactic pinning. Variables associated with contralateral SCIFE were identified using multivariate logistic regression models and adjusted for patient characteristics. This is at the time of the surgical procedure. Looked at odds ratios, and the false discovery rate was accounted for via the Benjamini-Hochberg method, which I will ask my methodology editor about in depth in just a little bit. So what did the authors find? They found that 15.3% of patients developed a contralateral SCIFE. This was 542 patients, at a mean of almost 300 days and a median of 190 days after the initial SCIFE. So not a long time frame afterwards. So from a counseling perspective, someone to say, well, when will it likely develop that they will see the other contralateral SCIFE side? Within a year, it's showing essentially. What are factors associated with an increased risk of contralateral SCIFE? Their primary outcome or factors that they know of already include things like hypothyroidism, which was measured by increased thyrotropin. They looked at younger aging boys defined as under 12 years old, younger aging girls under 11 years of age, severe obesity, which they defined as a body mass index greater than 120% of the 95th percentile or greater than or equal to 35 kilograms per meter squared, and then diabetes. So those are known factors that are increased risk for SCIFE. What are more novel factors that they found? The history of human growth hormone use, low vitamin D measured by calcidiol and less than 30 nanograms per milliliter, and tobacco exposure, including secondhand smoke. There were no differences with race and sex when it came to looking at these patients. So The take-home message is potentially within a year, you'll see a SCFI on the other side. It does help with counseling patients and talking to them, say, to the history of tobacco exposure, low vitamin D, which I don't think we typically check in our pediatric population, and human growth hormone, that you might have these in the future. So it might be worth screening x-rays and things like that. So this is a large database. I think the information in it is pretty straightforward. What I thought was interesting is the authors put a whole list of items that they thought that could be relevant to SCFI, and every single one of them were significant from a statistical standpoint. That said, I think that this information is actually useful in clinical practice.
When I was in residency, the chief of pediatrics on our PEDS rotation, he was very, very senior even then. And this was already at a time where they were doing, you know, percutaneous epiphyseodesis, but he liked to do the bone peg epiphyseodesis, which requires like an arthrotomy, like an open thing. And you got to see some great anatomy. I mean, that's for sure. But he would be like, why do you want to go in through a window when you could just open a door? He was on the wrong side of history for that, as it turns out, because nowadays we want to do every surgery through a window. We don't want to. Everything is minimally invasive. It was kind of like, because you don't want to go through, you weren't really going through a door. You were like blowing a hole in the wall is what you were doing. Was it really a door? It wasn't a natural entry. And you were really blowing a hole in the wall and then tearing down the entire house and reconstructing it with dead bone and steel.
Excavation. That always was really.
We didn't want to do it because it was less morbid. That's why it's a less morbid procedure. Anyway, wrong side of history, like I said. But that's neither here nor there right now. Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. It's Trinext data, which typically, Trinext is just another of the latest iterations in Clearinghouse. It's not different really from Pearl Diver or Market Scan or Truven Health. You know, there are various differences between those, but sort of the general sense of it is the same. It's a central warehouse, clearinghouse of claims-based, coding-based data. Some of them have lab values, okay. But, you know, by and large, there's not a whole lot of clinical granularity in terms of what the codes are actually representing radiographically, nor can you really characterize what these various, we'll call them euphemisms, because when they say diabetes mellitus, that's obviously a term for which there's a broad spectrum of condition behind it. There's, you know, type 1 diabetes that's been diagnosed in a 3 or 4 year old. There's type 2 diabetes that has developed in a very obese adolescent or something like that, let alone the blood sugar control and all of those other factors. So, you know, they're only limited to sort of see what they can see through the prism of these baked in terms and codes that exist. Plus with Trinext, that typically you have to like work through the Trinext interface. It's not like you can get all the data from Trinext and do whatever you want with it. It's already de-identified. So there's no way for them to validate or ensure the accuracy or do tests on the accuracy. And my biggest sort of, so, you know, the first thing that we say from a methodology standpoint is you really cannot use claims-based data to inform clinical care. That's a very common misstep. You can use it to discuss associations and findings, but you can't say, based on claims, we know that this condition leads to that condition. And, you know, a perfect example of this is history of human growth hormone use. Let's drill a little bit deeper below the surface on that. What does that mean?
It means anything. It can mean anything. It could be one shot. It could be like a continuous use of it.
Right. But people don't just have history of human growth hormone use because they, you know, all of a sudden decided one day, I'm just going to inject myself with human growth hormone. Like there's a whole clinical history behind that. And the root cause, I would say, is that this is a marker for endocrine, right? An endocrine disorder, which is a classic associated risk factor going all the way back to the Miller text review that I was using when I was a resident for bilateral slip capital femoral epiphysis. So it's presented in a different way. You're using a different term, but it really just harkens back. Like this is not history of human growth hormone use is going to be a mediator. It's in the middle of the pathway where the risk factor is hidden.
You're not wrong. So yeah, and it's all connected together.
Right. So I would say that probably the most interesting finding here, I would agree with you, is the tobacco exposure.
Mm-hmm. Not the smoking or something like that.
Yeah. It's important when you're looking at these, like they give you a lot of risk factors, as you say. I think in studies like this, where it's sort of a pastiche of we'll throw everything that we can think of at it, and they all turn out to be significant, like you said, just based on the power of the sample, is like if it's under 2, it's probably not something that you really want to like. But if it's over 2, as it is for the tobacco exposure, that's something that you might want to pay more attention to.
Cool stuff. All right. We're going to talk about joint replacement. We're going to talk about the efficacy. Efficacy of diosmin in reducing lower extremity swelling and pain after total knee arthroplasty, a randomized controlled multi-center trial by Wang et al. There's a commentary and it's free for 30 days.
This is the Your Cases on Hold featurette.
It is the featurette. So we both have input here, which will be interesting. So swelling and pain are obviously normal after total knee replacement. And we typically recommend things like rest, applying ice, compressive bandages, and elevation, our little RICE principle there. Diosim is a semi-synthetic flavonoid derived from hesperidin, and it's typically used to treat chronic venous insufficiency, not a medication that I typically see in practice. The mechanism is thought to be an ability to improve venous tone and lymphatic drainage, as well as the ability to reduce capillary hyperpermeability by protecting the microcirculation from inflammatory processes. This is a randomized controlled trial performed in China at 13 university centers with a minimum of 3-month follow-up. It was done July 23, 2021 to August 23, 2023, looking at unilateral total knee arthroplasty. There were a large number of restrictions for their patients. So to be an eligible patient for this study, there were a lot of them. So it does make the findings of the study maybe a little harder to apply in the real world because it was pretty restrictive. They used stratified block randomization, and the fact that they listed all the perioperative management, you know, in terms of injections, anesthesia, things like that is really good. But I find it a little hard to believe that all 13 institutions, which is possible to do, but all 13 institutions did the exact same protocol during the entire duration of the period of the study, including things like anesthesia. You know, I think our anesthesiologists from surgeon to surgeon in our own hospital differ, you know, let alone, but it is a protocol and they potentially followed it, but something to think about there. Patients are randomized to either get nothing or 14 days of 0.9 milligrams of oral diosmin twice daily. And the primary outcome was lower extremity swelling measured by a percentage, which was the post-op lower limb circumference minus the pre-op lower limb circumference divided by the pre-op lower limb circumference divided by 100, times 100%. They measured in 3 places. When the knee joint was in the extended position, they measured it at the thickest part of the calf, the upper pole of the patella, and 10 centimeters proximal to the patella in the thigh. And they assessed it multiple times. They were assessed at 24, 48, and 72 hours, and at 14 days postoperatively. And the swelling was measured 3 times at each location, and the mean value was recorded. So doing it in triplicates is always a good thing. There were multiple secondary outcomes, including VAS, pain at rest, and with their patient doing pain at motion when they flexed their knee to 60 degrees. Knee range of motion, HSS score, IL-6, interleukin-6, CRP to measure postoperative inflammation, and then a bunch of postoperative complications, including things like nausea, vomiting, falls, subcutaneous hemorrhage, venous injury, arterial injury, wound complications, and VTE, and vascular access complications and chronic pain. Chronic pain was characterized with a pain with a VAS score of greater than or equal to 4 during routine daily activities 3 months postoperatively. They did do a power analysis and they said they needed 122 patients and they accounted for 20% loss to follow up and aimed for 165 patients. They ended up with 153 patients in the control group and 156 patients in the case group. They used ANOVA, chi-square test, and Pearson bivariate correlation analysis. And they found that the groups did not significantly differ with respects to operative duration, length of stay, or discharge disposition. There were no significant differences in postoperative pain scores at rest. It did not significantly affect postoperative HSS scores. Interestingly enough, and this is probably the biggest one to note, it did not affect range of motion differences between groups or the levels of inflammatory biomarkers, and it didn't affect significantly the complication rates between groups. They did do some correlations, and they said that range of motion was negatively correlated with patella swelling and pain during range of motion. Pain during motion was also negatively correlated with the HSS score. They did say that diosteamine was associated with significantly less swelling of the calf, thigh, and upper pole of the patella, and significantly lower pain scores during motion, but is this functionally relevant? So even though swelling was reduced, it really didn't affect final range of motion despite the correlation. So while it's a nice idea to try to reduce swelling, patients don't like swelling, there can be some tightness associated with it. And patients have some subjective feelings of stiffness. It doesn't actually affect their range of motion after a total knee replacement. Thoughts, my friend and colleague?
All right. So the first thing I just want to bring up is more of just kind of a musing, coming at you with those new musings, like there's nothing more dangerous than a genius with money.
There's so many things to unpack in that one statement going.
So, I mean, they're not the only authors who do this. Like, we actually see this not infrequently, but it just, I always like get a chuckle because they're like, these are not just 13 hospitals where this work was done. These are 13 university affiliated hospitals. And some people double down even more or split aces, however you want to look at it. They're like, our study was performed at X number of quaternary academic, or you get tertiary academic affiliated university hospitals. Like, okay. It was like, I was into the study when I thought it was just done at hospitals, but now tell me more about your academic affiliated quaternary care hospitals. Like, it's just, those words don't mean anything. I've been at university hospitals that were absolutely, or university affiliated hospitals that were absolutely terrible. Like, and I've been at university affiliated hospitals that are some of like the best, you know, just being university affiliated or calling yourself academic, which we can also get into. I could spend a whole hour talking about like what people think they mean when they say academic and what they actually, like what actually, you know, I'm sure many will listen and many maybe have said, you know, you get the people who are like, when you're doing interviews and things like that, they tell you they want to go into privademics. And it's just like, we just.
I was one of those, so I can't talk.
I just, what? You were one of those? You told people you want to go to
privademics? No. Rothman was privademics in theory. So I was there. I was in it.
I disagree 100%. Rothman is not privademics. Academic versus private practice is one thing. It's not talking about a compensation model. So Rothman is academic. There's probably not any more academic, like certainly in the spine space, and I think probably in joints as well. There's probably not a more academic institution than Thomas Jefferson Rothman Institute.
Pretty academic.
Yeah. So it's the privademic thing is a conflation of like the way you get paid, essentially, like with the practice model or the environment, but I that's going down a rabbit hole that we probably shouldn't go down right now. Happy to have that conversation at a later point. Stay tuned for our next special issue where we'll just spend an hour, bonus episode. We'll just spend an hour talking about that. So that's amusing. The part that I would really just sort of say like, whoa, hold the phone here is, you know, they do a randomized study, the sine qua non of gold standard investigation in scientific research, and they have results. They had statistically significant findings. The study was well powered. There are not any limitations on that front. And then they say further studies are needed. Whoa, nope. You should not, your conclusion from a randomized controlled trial, unless you end up being underpowered, there are no significant findings, and there are reasons for that, such as underpowering or like in the sports studies. You get, you know, a lot of violations of the randomization, refusal to participate, you know, and then you have to do an intent to treat analysis that doesn't necessarily mirror, you know, you're calling patients who received surgery non-operative, right? Like it just doesn't match up. When it's something like this, where there are really no holes in sort of the way the work was conducted, to say more research needs to be done, that's not the point of a randomized controlled trial. Should have a definitive answer, and it shouldn't be, oh, we're not sure. when you have definitive answers here. And the definitive answers I get are not what you wanted them to be, but they seem pretty definitive to me. So I contest more research needs. More research can always be called for, but I don't see the need for more research. I think this is a pretty concrete answer. The use of dioxin after total knee arthroplasty reduced some swelling and pain during motion, but it was not associated with, you know, meaningful real outcomes, right? And that's probably the reality. We're seeing an accurate reflection of reality. More research isn't likely to change that, in my estimation.
Now we're going on to our honorable mentions. We're going to look at the long-term follow-up of untreated adult patients with spondylothoracic dystosis, or Jarkko-Levin syndrome, by Ramirez et al. Spondylothoracic dystosis, or STD, is a rare autosomal disorder affecting the formation of the spine, characterized by a complete bilateral fusion of the ribs at the costovertebral junction, producing a crab-like appearance of the thorax. This is a long-term follow-up study, so it included a small number of patients, specifically 5 male and 6 female patients. The authors confirmed the expected restrictive pattern in pulmonary function, but interestingly, these subjects exhibited better early-onset scoliosis questionnaire scores compared with those reported in neuromuscular populations. PFT results and thoracic height did not correspond to PROMIS and early-onset scoliosis questionnaire scores, questioning the use of these parameters as a surgical indication. The authors suggested that the STD diagnosis should not be an absolute indication for vector expansion thoracoplastic surgery. Our next one is evaluation of proximal femoral bone mineral density in cementless total hip arthroplasty, a 3-arm prospective randomized controlled trial by Hooper et al. And there's a commentary on this as well. In this study, 119 patients were randomized to receive either a proximally coated collarless dual taper wedge stem. Next is a proximal coated collarless anatomic stem or a fully coated collarless triple taper stem. And these surgeries were all performed through the posterior approach and DEXA scans were obtained. At 2 years, the femoral bone mineral density was maintained after using these 3 different cementless femoral designs, and all of them achieved excellent improvement in patient-reported outcomes. The stems designed to load the proximal metaphyseal region resulted in higher bone mineral density in that region. However, there was no stress shielding or no significant stress shielding observed. The next study is incidence of nerve palsies during pavlik harness treatment for developmental dysplasia of the hip, a retrospective cohort study. This is by Gross et al., and there's an infographic. It's also free for 30 days. There were 351 patients, and there were 547 hips evaluated in the study. In these patients that received these pavlik harnesses, 22 of them developed a femoral nerve palsy, which is 4% of all treated hips. There was 2 cases of brachial plexus palsy, which is 0.4%, and 1 case of inferior gluteal nerve palsy, which is 0.2%. Patients with nerve palsies had more severe DDH as measured by the graft classification and more severe DDH as measured on physical exam via the Barlow and Ortolani maneuvers. Finally, bilateral external torque CT scan reliably detects syndesmotic lesions in an experimental cadaver study by Beeler et al. This was compared to the healthy side with greater sensitivity at 84% and similar specificity at 95% compared with the arthroscopic lateral hook test. The area under the curve for the bilateral external torque CT scan was 95%. Higher torque amounts increased the rate of true positive results. Thanks very much for joining us for another episode, and we look forward to the next one of Your Cases on Hold.